I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Jeff Peterson. He is a seasoned entrepreneur and real estate investor based in Cary, North Carolina. Some familiar ground for me going back to NC State. Jeff is the author of Are We There Yet? A Guide to Conquering Every Twist and Turn on the Journey to Success. And, you know, as I was talking to Jeff in the green room, I was really excited about getting started with this because, you know, anybody that has a business, we have the tendency to look at the guy at the next business over and just think they have it all figured out. And, you know, it can be sometimes frustrating. And I think Jeff's story is going to be interesting. He didn't build his portfolio with big investors, and he started at 17 with no parachute. He just had to find a way to make things work, support himself and support others. And since then, he's built out a portfolio worth multiple millions. And not only that, he's quite the athlete. Ran 8 Boston marathons, numerous Ironmans, Spartan races, and many others. Jeff, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate you putting me on your show. And I enjoy talking with you in the green room as well. So that was interesting to talk to, and hopefully we can just keep it going. So yeah. Very nice. Very nice, Craig. Thank you.
Well, and you know, it's funny how things go when, you know, we were talking about this, when the information I was given a LinkedIn account or LinkedIn profile of somebody who lived in Minnesota. And I'm hearing you talk about North Carolina, specifically East Carolina, you know, like East Carolina University. I'm like, does anybody in Minnesota even know that ECU exists? And
probably not.
I mean, it's a great school, but it's just, and it's in a beautiful part of North Carolina, but not a part of North Carolina a lot of people go.
That's true. So, of course, growing up in Eastern North Carolina, ECU is kind of like the big school. So there's ECU, Carolina, and State, right?
Yeah.
So you're pretty much going to go to one of those three. And if not that, you're going to go to App State. So East Carolina was the closest to where I lived, right? And that was the one that my sisters went there. So we always go there to the games. And so you became a fan just because of that. But also, I was a big State fan as well. So, you know, You kind of, anybody in State, you like those schools.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's, well, and I went to State, which was very, very good school. Changed a lot since I was there. But now you said you grew up near Camp Lejeune.
I did. I grew up in Richlands, actually. So Richlands is in Onslow County, which is about, 20 miles from Camp Lejeune. So it's next to Jacksonville. Richlands is a farming community. And so that's where I grew up. I wasn't a farmer, but I worked in tobacco before. And I'll tell you the thing about working in tobacco as a kid, you quickly realize that is not what you want to do with your life. You're like, you know what? I better figure out something because I don't want to be cropping tobacco, you know, much more in these hot summers. So it's not the best way to make a living, but it's good for that. It's good for that one or two summers, and that's about it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, I was stationed at Cherry Point, which is in Havelock, and it's wild. Havelock and Cherry Point, or Havelock and Jacksonville, couldn't be more different. There's just a different vibe in the air when you drive through town.
Yeah, I would think the same thing there.
Yeah, but it's, it gets complicated. So as somebody who worked in the tobacco fields, I've got to ask you about a historic tobacco food. What is your favorite barbecue?
Eastern North Carolina barbecue. Has to be, right?
Right. Which one?
Well, I like Smithfield's is good, but that's kind of generic, right? So that wouldn't be my favorite. My favorite would probably be Pete's. in Aiden. So I
Okay.
don't even know if they're still there anymore, but it's right outside of Greenville on the way to Jacksonville.
Okay. Yeah, there was one in Goldsboro that I used to stop at. And I
Oh,
forgot the
what is
name of
that
it.
name? That I think I know which one you're talking about, but I'm trying to. There's a Bee's in Greenville that was good as well, but you don't find too much barbecue places around here. Not
No.
real ones. There is one right on Chatham Street, heading towards NC State, and the name of that, it escapes me, but it's very good.
Yeah, I've eaten there. I would say Stamey's in Greensboro is a really good one. So if you're ever over in Greensboro, it's
Okay.
right across the street from the Coliseum.
Yeah.
So, well, cool. And so how did you get started? I mean, just to give people focus, your biggest project that you're working on right now, you're wrapping up, I think, is Peterson Station. And what is it? Give us a rough description of what that property is.
Well, it's like Trump Towers, but not like that. Actually, it's nothing like that. It just has his, no, it has my name on it, not his name on it, but
Yeah.
basically I said, hey, work for Trump, so I'll put Peterson on it. Actually, it wasn't even my idea. So all joking aside, what it was, it's mixed use. So it's 316 apartments and 47,000 feet of retail. And to do that, I had to assemble nine different pieces of property. One of them that I owned originally, and the one that I owned originally was an old trailer park. And when I say old trailer park, it was an old trailer park, and I bought it 25 years ago. Yes, it was 25 years ago. And it was just great location. And I bought it because it cash flowed some, but I knew it was going to be something else eventually. And then, long story, I wound up buying all the neighbors around, but that took, I didn't do that for a long time. And when I did do it, it didn't take that long to do it. But I bought all the neighboring property so I could put that big property together.
Wow. And you said it's a $150 million project.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's one of those that, and I say this about many things, and I'm sure a lot of people say this about their business too. If I knew what I didn't know, I would have never started.
Yeah.
Never try to tackle that. I mean, it was way out of my league. I mean, it was just it really was. So doing that, I just had this thing, look, I can do it. I mean, they did it right down the street. Someone else did it. I can do it. But there's a big, that's a huge leap. You know what, when I'm talking to the bankers, I'm like, look, the math is still the same. I just moved a decimal point. That's it. It's the same thing. You know, but bankers don't look at it like that, do they? Not really. So it's not really the same thing. And there's so many twists and turns on that project. I mean, it took me way over 10 years to get it to where it is right now, once I started. So COVID hit and there was a lot of stuff that happened in the background, but yeah, it was not a straight linear path on that project either. But
So is, and I don't know, for a property that size, do you use the term CO? Do you have a CO for the property?
yeah, you have to get a certificate of occupancy. Is that what
Yeah.
you're, yeah. Yeah. So there's actually the way they do it on a property like this is they'll do several conditional certificate of occupancy. So seven different buildings, and they'll give you a temporary CO on the first two. And before they'll give you another one, you have to finish this part of the road, or you have to put in the traffic light, or you have to. So there's a lot of things that the town will say, okay, we see where you've got this, and we see where you're making progress, and we know you need to start generating income. So we'll let you have this. But before we'll give you the certificate of occupancy on building number three, you're going to have to take this step. So they are pretty good to work with that way.
Yeah. So is it complete? Where does it stand?
The residential is complete. The clubhouse, parking, everything's in there. The road improvements have all been done. The last part is the upfits on the retail. So we're started working on those right now. So 6 months, everyone will be in there.
Wow, that's good. And so then do you still have like construction loans that have to be converted at some point?
Yeah. So I worked this one when I finally came down. I worked it with a developing partner. Developing partner is a big outfit. They took the construction loan, and then we swapped. At the very end, we'll swap apartments for retail. And there's like 80 pages of documents in there to get it all the way done. But it actually took it off of my balance sheet while it was being completed. So that was good.
Wow.
And that's how I actually got it to go past where it was.
You know, there's a outdoor mall next to me that cost $192 million to build, and construction was complete like 07, 08, and they couldn't get new loans. They couldn't convert the loans, and it just went into bankruptcy. They ended up selling the property for $75 million.
Yeah, so that's what happens a lot of times in these development deals. And I was telling this to a friend of mine just the other day, actually. It's usually the second developer that comes in and makes a killing. The first one can get burned, right? So if somebody comes in and you're the number two developer, you know you're going to do well. It's the first guy that's already he's already spent every dime he's got. He's tapped out. He can't get the loans. Maybe the economy took a turn while he's under construction and that everything dried up. A lot of times those are the guys that get burned, but usually the second one, all the infrastructure is in, everything's nearing completion. He can step right in at a discounted price and get it done. You see that happen a lot. I've never been in that position either way, fortunately. Well, I'd like to be in the second position, but I haven't been in the first one yet. So
But that's an interesting insight. I mean, would it be possible to structure a business where your business model is you're the second developer, you look for
yeah,
developments?
it's called Vultures Are Us.
Oh.
That might even actually be a business. I don't know. I just made that up, but that's what it seemed like, right? Way back in the day, I did some foreclosures, like would buy up foreclosures, and I have to tell you, I just didn't like it. It just didn't make you feel good at the end of the day, you know. So and there's a need for it. There really is a need for it, and somebody's going to buy it. I just didn't like dealing with them. So I just don't have that appetite. Now, some big conglomerate and you're doing a multi-million-dollar thing, I guess that's fine. But small scale, I didn't want to do it.
Well, you know, one of the things that fascinates me is real estate. And the one thing I know about myself is I know nothing about it. And you know, when I moved to Greensboro, I bought a house that was one lot away from a neighborhood called Sedgefield, which is kind of a nice neighborhood, a very old, nice neighborhood in Greensboro. And that house today is worth about what I paid for it in 99, which was
Isn't that funny?
exactly, maybe a few dollars more. And I always thought if I'd bought in Raleigh, I was going to buy around Lake Johnson. And the one thing I've seen is, which for me, it looks like a lovely area right around this little lake,
Yeah.
but it doesn't seem to have appreciated like other parts of Raleigh.
I see that too. Sometimes I'll look at something and go like, "Wow, this is going to be worth $1 million. It's going to be worth this," and then it never seems to quite take off. And I've seen that. I'm trying to think of the example that I was thinking of like that. But people will say, "Well, what kind of property do you buy? What do you buy?" I said, "Well, I buy the good, the bad, and what in the world was I thinking when I got that?" So I bought the bad too. The stuff that you're like, "Oh my gosh!" When I say bad, it just doesn't really pay off. I haven't like got burned, but I mean something that just languishes, like what you're talking about, your house in it was in Greensboro. It's like you just wait for years and years and years, and it never really appreciates. Most property is going to appreciate over time, but if you're playing that game where you're gonna quick flip properties and it's going to go up right away because something's coming in, I mean it's a very dangerous game to play. I mean you have to look long haul. I mean, that's what I do. I always look at everything like what it's going to be in 5 years or 10 years, never thinking that I'm going to be able to flip it in a year or 2 years. So that's kind of the way I examine them. But even then, I've been wrong. So, yeah.
Well, and I guess that's kind of my question. It's because I see people killing it in real estate. And one of my questions is, what have they figured out that I haven't? And I'm interested in your take.
How many have you done?
Oh, not much. And so I haven't played around because, you know, my experience in Greensboro was so bad. And then I moved here to Austin, and just pure dumb luck, I bought a house in the suburb of Austin that nobody had heard of, and now everybody knows it. Like Seth Rogen lives right around the corner from me, And this is just pure dumb luck. This would make me look like a real estate genius, but I know too well it was just dumb luck.
Yeah. Well, you know the old saying about real estate, right? So if you buy it today, you pay too much and you look like a schmuck, right? Or you just look
Yeah.
ignorant. 5 years from now, that same property, you're okay. 10 years, you're looking smart. 20 years from now, you look like a genius. You know, so the real key is you just have to wait it out. Most property, some property, not, it doesn't work like that, but most of the times, property is forgiving. You know, real estate, if you pay a little bit too much, it's going to forgive you. But if you try to get out real quick, if you have to, you know, if you're looking at 3 years, don't do it. I mean, just do something, do everything for the long haul. So with me, it's appreciation, but it's also about if it will cash flow, if you can carry everything while you're waiting. So you don't want to be upside down in a property. With me, that was especially true, especially when you're starting out in property. You can't start out trying to invest in speculation. So the example would be my Peterson station. Okay, if I had bought that when I first looked at it and I didn't have a trailer park on it, I was like, you know what? In 10 years, this is going to be worth $1 million. I should buy this. But I would not have been able to afford to carry that note. I would have been strung out, just strung out, and wouldn't be able to do anything else. So for me, being a small property investor, I had to make sure that everything kind of cash flowed early on, or at least broke even, and waited for the appreciation. And then, of course, you're getting your added benefits of what your depreciation and, you know, everything else that comes with it. But if you can't do that to begin with, you're going to be in a world of hurt quick. So that's one thing that I've always tried to stay away from, is just straight up speculation. And I've done it a time or two, and it's not worked as well. So.
You know, one of the things I've thought is like I thought it would be interesting to buy either mixed use or some office space just to have my office there so that as rents go up and what have you, I'm at least pegged down to a low cost. And I see there's a grocery store chain here in Austin or in Central Texas. They're based out of San Antonio called HEB. And they will buy the entire shopping center. And they become the landlord of all the other ones. Now, HEBs have gotten bigger, so now they are the entire shopping center. But, you know, a number of years ago, HEB would be like the anchor tenant in the shopping center and then have other people, but they were also the landlord. And I thought, you know, in a competitive business like groceries, that probably helps because that keeps their real estate cost relatively low, you know, as everything appreciates.
Well, you actually touched on something that's very interesting. So that's how I do mine. Like, I have a consignment store and upholstery shop. Still, I still have the upholstery shop back from what, 45 years now? Gosh, it's hard to believe. But anyway, so I still have that, and it's downtown Cary, but I bought the property way back in the day. And when I bought it, you know, it wasn't the first thing that I did, but it was just a big project for me. And I bought enough of it so that I could rent out spaces in there. So actually, all of the tenants pay for all the space, and I rent to myself as well. So I do that in all the businesses that I have. I own the property, and then I rent out spaces to other people. So I've got the, you know, guaranteed rental income, and I'm saving myself, like, my business. I know it's going to make it, even if it's not doing well, because I own the property, and other people are paying the rent. So that it works out really well.
So I've heard two schools of thought. One is give yourself a bargain on your own rent, and the other is charge your business fair market value for rent. Do you have a thought on that?
I do. I charge fair market, because if your business can't pay fair market, then what are you doing there? You're basically subsidizing your business with your property. So you charge the business a fair market rent, and if the business can't sustain that, then you're in the wrong business. So you may have to evict yourself, more or less. But seriously, you have to look at that. You have to look at it kind of straight up. I mean, now, depending upon how the accounting works, you can cut yourself a deal, or you can do something, but you really have to do your internal bookwork to play it straight up, to make sure that it's worth it even staying in that business. The example would be, I have a salon in Jacksonville, which is a 40 booth salon. So it's a big salon, 8,000 feet, and it's inside my shopping center. And I charge them rent. I mean, I charge myself rent. And I actually overcharged the rent. But anyway, if that couldn't afford that rent, I couldn't stay there. Like, it wouldn't make sense. I'd rather get a regular tenant in there because, you know, I'm hurting my property. So you can't hurt your property to help your business. You're just, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of another, right? So that's kind of the way I do it.
No, and I like that. I like that.
And but the other part of that, the other part that I want to touch on. So if do you have office space now, or are you out of your home, or are you?
No, I work mostly on my home, and then there's a co-working space, and my team's distributed. I kept hiring people, and then they'd move away, and I didn't want to fire them.
Yeah.
And so we end up. It was my intention to have an office with employees. And just the way life went, they kept moving away, and I didn't want to fire them. So we were both basically remote.
Yeah, I can see that, especially COVID, during the COVID times, right?
Yeah, thankfully I was out of that before COVID. And it was nice to be out of that before COVID.
Well, what you touched on before is if you had office space, and you'd say you'd get more space than what you need and rent it out to other people, right? The positive part of that, the real positive part, is when you go to the banks, say you want to build a 20,000 square foot building, and you're going to take 50% of that yourself and rent out the other 50%. Well, the banks love that. They love it if it's owner occupied. So if you go in there as your business and your business is the tenant, they're much more comfortable than if you're just speculative real estate. So that's it. Most banks say it's a 50%. So if you say you're 50% occupied with your business in there, they're much more likely to work with you on favorable terms, everything's going to be a lot better.
Really? So
it's a really big added bonus. It's kind of like buying a house for yourself and then moving out of it and renting it out eventually, but you're going to get your best rates if you move in it yourself first.
Yeah. So now, one of the things you brought up, and I think this is a good time to kind of pivot to just, you know, the concept of business in general. And I thought you made a really good point that if your business can't afford the rents of the space that it's in, you've got a broken business. And obviously, you figured a lot of things out over the years. What were some of the hardest? Let's start with the hard lessons. You know, let's start with the embarrassing ones, and then we'll talk about the successes.
Oh, we never talked about the embarrassing ones. Okay, go ahead. All right, go ahead. I'm good.
Now, what were some hard lessons that you had to learn?
Well, you know, so growing up, I worked. You know, like most people today that are entrepreneurs, if you talk to every one of them, I will guarantee you, every single person said, from the time he was 10 years old or 12 years old, he had a lawn cutting business. He had this, he had that. You're just hustled, right? And that was true of myself too. So I did, you know, of course, then I did the Boy Scouts. I was an Eagle Scout. I did all that kind of stuff. But the hustling part, you know, working in tobacco and then working, you know, I was driving a school bus. So that's an interesting story. So back in the day in Richlands, the students were the school bus drivers. So, which is interesting because you have your senior high school students driving the school bus of 75 kids, you know, K through eight, or mine was K through eight. But you drive school buses, which to me, that was the best job ever because you had to go to school. You got paid to drive it. You had to come home. You got paid to drive it. And so when you're getting paid, you got to miss the first half of the first period of school and you missed the last half of the last period of school. So you got out of some school. Be in charge of 75 kids. That was a hard lesson. What was hard about that? It was a great job. I loved it. The hard part was disciplining those kids. I mean, keeping them quiet and things you had to do. So when I did mine, most people got bus driver's license because everybody got a license. Like everybody tried to get it, right? But very few people got buses because there weren't that many buses. My sister was a bus driver before me. So she was a senior and didn't want to drive her bus anymore because of what she was doing. So I substituted for her. So at 16 years old, I got my 16 years old on the day I got my driver's license, 16 plus 3 days, I got my bus driver's license. And that's when I started driving the bus. So at 16, I was driving the school bus.
Wow.
Which, you know, if it was my kids riding the bus and I saw me, I would not let them get on that bus.
No.
No, who would, right? But, you know, a perfect driving record in the whole school. Nobody ever, there was no major incidents. The biggest incident for me was keeping that bus quiet when you pulled up, and there's some things I would do that wasn't quite as mature as I am today. You know, to keep them quiet, I would feather the gas pedal, and it would buck the kids back and forth and made them fly over the seats. You know, just stupid stuff. But
yeah. Yeah,
I dodged that. But anyway, I won't regress into that. I could talk all day about being a bus driver, but less fun was at the time then too. So I was doing that to make money. And then I went to work for my parents, who had a small upholstery shop. And fairly quickly, they were kind of on the downslide, and they had lost their upholsters. So I was the only upholsterer. My mom was the seamstress. And she didn't know how to sew, and I didn't know how to upholster. So that was hard. That was really hard.
Yeah.
But I figured it out. Yeah. So.
Well, and you know, it's interesting when you have no other choice but to figure it out. It seems like you do figure it out.
You know, it was no more complicated than you'd put a sofa on, we call them horses or bucks. And he put it on there and said, okay, there's $600 sitting there. I didn't look at it like there was a piece of furniture to upholster. I looked at it, there was $600, and we had to get that $600 to pay the bills. That was it.
Yeah.
So you had to figure it out. So that's what we did, no matter what. So
yeah.
I wouldn't want to go back doing that again. So yeah.
No, I've had that in my own business where, you know, our first engagement with everybody is something we call a first time offer, which is a stupidly cheap front end offer that's loaded with a ton of value, but it's like a coffee date to just kind of get to know each other, figure out if we work well together. And the back end closing rate on that and conversion rate on that's 80%. And there have been days where I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh, I don't want the paperwork, you know, to send this in, because I promised him. It was the same thought. I'm like, I would put a dollar figure to it and multiply by 80%. I'm like, that's how much money is sitting there if I'll just get off my butt and spend the 2 or 3 hours yep. to do the work.
Yeah, that's it. I look at every single thing like that. When it's the same thing when something costs, like, well, it only costs $100. No, we make 50 cents on the, or no, actually, you know, like in some of the stuff, we make 20 cents on the dollar. So it doesn't cost you $100. It costs you $500. $500 in sales to pay for that item. Is it worth $500? Because that's what it's really costing you, right? It's not costing you $100, it's costing you $500. So that's how I kind of teach my children and teach the employees, go like, okay, it's only $100, but if we're only making 20 cents on the dollar, that means we have to make $500 to pay for that. Is that worth it? No. Okay. There you go. That's my answer.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way you have to look at small business. I think you have to look at it like, what is the real cost? What is the true cost? So if your cost of goods sold 80% on something or 50%, then you know that's what it's really costing you. Double that.
Yeah. Well, what other lessons would you share as we kind of wrap up? What would be some final thoughts of wisdom that you've learned in your journey that you'd love to share with others?
You know, well, real estate, of course, there's so many tidbits on that. I mean, if one thing I like to say, and I don't think we've shared this or stepped on it, but if you're beginning or you're thinking about getting into the entrepreneurial journey, you're going to open up a business, or maybe you work for somebody else and you want to start, branch out on your own, or you want to buy some real estate, the first thing you need to do if you're getting ready to quit your job is to borrow every dollar you can while you have that job, right? Borrow all your money right now. Borrow against your house, borrow against your credit cards, get a HELOC, get anything you can, because once you open that business, you're dead to the banks. You're going to be dead for a couple of years. Because you're going to need 2 good years of tax returns before you're going to be eligible to even borrow anything again. And that's 2 good years. So it may take you 3 or 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest thing that you can do is make sure that you have tapped out everything you can while you have a W-2. While you have that W-2, because once you don't have that, it's a whole different game.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, that's fascinating. Jeff, thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies. Your book is Are We There Yet? And people can get that on Amazon. How can people reach you?
Well, they can reach me through my email, which is jmp521@aol.com. Maybe you have show notes down there. I'm not sure. You can find me on LinkedIn, just not the Minnesota Jeffrey Peterson, the other one. You can find me on LinkedIn or any social media. Of course, I'll be on there as well. But if you look at my book on Amazon, then you can see how to contact me from there as well, I believe. So, yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
I enjoyed it, Craig. Enjoyed talking with you.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.